Thanks everyone for getting back so promptly after lunch. This is our session 11B, which is our ATO update. We're lucky to have Paul Dalahunty, who is from the ATO, and who's just finished his secondment, or is
short-term
temporary
acting, I think,
acting role as head of the SMCF segment, and he is now director of SMCF trustee and risk. So, thank you for attending today, Paul. We look forward to your session.
Thanks, Phil. And good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back here again presenting for the Tax Institute. And I guess fantastic also to see SMSF issues taking on such prominence as part of the conference agenda. And there's always an element of trepidation, I think, presenting the day after Halloween. There's been a run on pitchforks in the last week. My children probably front and centre in picking them up, but glad to see no one's brought them with them today. So always when the ATO talks, there's an element of feedback that we like to receive. But today's session I'll hone in on key issues that the ATO has had at front of its focus for the SMSF industry. And in terms of the content, I'll spend a little bit of time context setting on the current state of the SMSF industry. This follows the recently published quarterly statistics for June 2024, which provides the latest update on the size and scale of the SMSF sector. There's also been some key updates on our industry support and guidance, and I'll note that today. I'll then cover off on our priority compliance areas for funds, including observations on contraventions being reported, and our approach to registrations and illegal early access. And to round it out at the end, I'll provide an update on what we're seeing with SMSF audits of behaviour, one of my favourite areas, and that might provide a nice segue as well into the 12B session, where I'm sure Bryce and Shirley will provide some helpful advice for auditors on engaging with the ATO when they're being audited. Now, as I have only 30 minutes to get through all of this, I'll try and keep things short and sharp, and apologies in advance if there isn't much opportunity for questions, but we'll see how we go along the way, and might wait for those questions to be asked at the end so we can get through as much as possible. So jumping right into it, so as mentioned, we've recently published our June 2024 quarterly statistics. This provides the latest overview of the SMSF sector, and just so you know, you can access the detail of this report on ato.gov.au or at data.gov.au. And the stats for the quarter highlight the continued growth that's occurring in the sector. And so during the 2023-24 financial year, we had over 32,000 new funds enter the system. And this was a 21% increase in the funds compared to that observed in 2022-23. But that data does relate to new funds, and obviously there are a number of exits that occur from the system. And cumulatively though, over the 5-year period from June 2019, there's been a net increase in funds by over 60,000. And that brings us to a current population of SMSFs to just over 625,000. Which includes over 1,150,000 members. So there's been significant growth that's been occurring in recent years. In terms of the total asset size of the industry, the total estimated assets is now at $990 billion. And that's a 7.5% increase from our 2023 figure of $920 billion. Now, the reason I say it's estimated for the $990 billion is because we only have reliable lodgement data for funds up until the end of the 2023 financial year at this stage, with the 2024 lodgement cycle only having recently commenced. So in coming up with the June 2024 figure, we use industry modelling to predict the growth that's likely to have occurred in the sector. So it's not an absolute figure. But based on the trajectory that we are seeing and the contributions that we know that are happening for SMSFs, as well as new entrants into the system, there's an obvious likelihood that SMSFs will tip over the $1 trillion mark this financial year. In terms of the top assets held by SMSFs, listed shares continue to be in first place, making up about 28% of the value of total estimated SMSF assets. Cash and term deposits also have a higher rate of value, making up approximately 16% of all assets. Now, I'm going to leave it there in relation to the stats, but if you'd like more detail on the current population stats, they are available on our webpage and you can find it by searching under QC103083. Now, with the growth in the sector, we continue to explore new ways to ensure that those entering the system are supported and can understand their responsibilities. And we've recently released our third publication titled Running a Self-Managed Super Fund to help existing and prospective trustees. And this publication provides guidance on things such as contributions and rollovers, managing investments, paying benefits, and administering and reporting responsibilities. Now, this new publication complements our two existing publications, which are titled Starting an SMSF and Winding Up an SMSF. So I've now published the trilogy. Great bedtime reading if you want to get into it. And you can get more information on these publications via QC103077 on our webpage. And one further area where we have been working to support trustees is via our newly developed online education courses. The Starting an SMSF and Winding Up an SMSF education modules were publicly released via our Small Business Learning Needs portal in July of this year. And we expect the third one, Running an SMSF module, to be available before the end of the year. Now, although these products can be accessed by anyone, there's also an extra facet to this for us as a regulator. So once the Running an SMSF module is released, the ATO will be in a position to use these products as part of any direction notices that we issue in responding to fund compliance issues that we may identify. So to provide a quick update what's happening in relation to the guidance space, I think most of you would be aware that we had some important and long-awaited legislative changes earlier this year to the non-arm's length income provisions that happened in June. Those changes, known as the NALE changes for non-arm's length general expenses, do apply from the 1st of July 2018. And they do have relevance for a couple of important ATO rulings that have been subject to much discussion and where industry has been keenly awaiting updates for us. Now, the first one is Law Companion Ruling LCR 2021/2, which relates to non-arm's length income consequences when a fund incurs non-arm's length expenditure. And the second one is Draft Tax Ruling 2010/1DC, which relates to a contribution to a fund, but also has relevance to the interaction between the contribution rules and the non-arm's length rules. And post the NALE legislative amendments in June, we have been progressing updates to these documents. And I'm happy to say that the release of those documents or those updates is now imminent. It's expected that the documents will be released in draft form for public consultation, and this is expected to occur before the end of November. In addition to those two tax rulings, or one LCR, the other tax ruling, is the updates that we've made to Taxation Ruling 2013/5. Which is in relation to income streams and when they commence and cease. Now, some of the amendments that have been made to the tax ruling, particularly those in relation to funds failing to make minimum pension payments, is an area that has generated a lot of discussion since the ruling's release. And on that point, I'll direct you to the FAQs, which are located on QC39769 on the ATO webpage, which do complement the ruling and help explain the ATO's position for practitioners and trustees. So moving on to issues relevant to the funds, or to funds, and the first priority area I want to talk to today is the focus we're bringing to new fund registrations. And as mentioned earlier, we processed over 32,000 new applications last financial year. And important to note is that for every SMSF application we receive, we do subject it to our risk model, which means that we consider the risks associated with the trustees and other entities that they have controlled. And while most applications do not have any concerns, we do have staff involved in reviewing the highest risk applications to determine if they should be approved. And there are some specific factors that we look at as part of our vetting process, and that is to look at whether individuals, as part of the application, have a history of insolvency, whether they've been convicted of crimes related to dishonesty, those that have concerns with their personal lodgement and payment history, or where we have information about identities that have been compromised or potentially used fraudulently. And an SMSF will be withheld from Superfund lookup when a new registrant is deemed high risk. And to prevent the rollover, and that is to prevent the rollover from occurring, thereby safeguarding the member's superannuation. And one of the drivers behind us doing this work is that we want to make sure funds are not being fraudulently set up or set up for the purpose of rolling over amounts from an APRA fund purely for the purpose of illegally accessing those funds, and I'll get to illegal early access soon. But where illegal early access is identified or a risk is identified, we will escalate the case for audit, which will then involve either a full interview, especially if we think there's a promoter involved, or an educative conversation with a trustee to mitigate the risk of illegal early access occurring. Now, in terms of our registration performance standards and how they're situated, around 75 to 80% of SMSF registrations are processed and registered on Superfund lookup within 3 days. Now, whilst that's a pretty good stat for us in terms of helping those looking to establish an SMSF quite quickly, we're also aware of the rise of fraudsters and scammers in the industry. And to combat that, This safeguard, or with safeguard registration process, is, involves us implementing additional identity checks when a fund is first established. And further, we now issue protective alerts when there are changes to a fund's details or when a new member is added. Now, having mentioned schemers and scammers, in recent years we have seen an increase in sophistication of arrangements being marketed to facilitate illegal early release. Now, these arrangements are often promoted to vulnerable individuals, and based on the number of applications coming in, our radar is up in relation to schemers or promoters that are involved in new registrant applications. So in response, we have increased our compliance and focus on SMSF trustees who have accessed their retirement savings before they have met a condition of release. And we've also increased our scrutiny on those people who are promoting illegal early access schemes. Now, whilst we have a dedicated compliance program that we're undertaking in conjunction with ASIC to deal with promoters, there can be significant consequences as well for the trustees who become involved and who get drawn into those illegal early access arrangements. And over the last 2 years, we've been pretty active in pursuing those trustees, and we've disqualified over 1,400 trustees. And this has been largely due to illegal early access of superannuation. And it's not only the disqualification, where appropriate, compliance actions have also resulted in additional tax and penalties being applied to those trustees. And I guess this comes from the experience of knowing that individuals who establish an SMSF and roll over funds from their APRA account and then never lodge an SMSF annual return are at the highest risk of committing illegal early access. And the number of newly established SMSFs failing to lodge their first annual return has grown to 15% for those that were registered in 2022-23. So these funds are a natural point of concern for us. As part of bringing greater focus to the issue for the industry, in February of this year, we released the Illegal Early Access Estimate, which is an annual estimate of the total amount of super withdrawn by SMSF members before they are legally entitled to do so. And so for the 2022-2020 year, we estimated that $381 million of super has been illegally withdrawn by trustees. And in 2021, we estimated it was $256 million. We're currently in the process of finalising our estimate for 2022 and expect to announce this in early 2025. Now, an important point to also reference here is that we are seeing more and more instances of payments which have been made to members that have been dressed up as loans for the purpose of reporting, with the obvious intent by trustees of seeking to avoid the payment being seen as a superannuation benefit to a member where the member hasn't met a condition of release. And the first point I'd like to make on this is that if a fund loans money to any member or their relatives, it is a breach of Section 65 of the CIS Act, and that in itself is seen by the ATO as being a serious breach. The second point is that you cannot rewrite history in relation to events of the fund. So for something to be considered a loan, there are a range of things that you'd expect to see reflected in the loan arrangement. Things such as a formal loan agreement, specific terms for period and interest, details on any security which may be offered, and then observances can also be made on what has actually happened in relation to payments of principal and interest in line with that arrangement. So dressing up a legal early access as a loan arrangement to try and pass it off as a more legitimate type of arrangement is obviously not appropriate. And the ATO will always look at the substance of a transaction in determining how it should be classified. Now on to non-lodgement. And although non-lodgement from an illegal early access perspective is problematic, it's also become a creeping problem for us in relation to a larger population of funds within the industry. And I think it's important to reiterate that as a core principle, the most fundamental compliance obligation for all trustees is to lodge their SMSF annual return. This is because without lodgement, there is no visibility of the fund's compliance with its regulatory and tax obligations or the superannuation balances of its members. So given that we're now past due dates for the 2023 SARs, where are we at with lodgement? Well, it's not a great story. And although we've always had a proportion of the population who failed to lodge on time, the problem does seem to be growing. And for 2023 SARs, we still have over 1,000 funds that are still yet to lodge. So in comparison to the full population of 625,000, that's a fairly sizable proportion. So as a regulator, what are we doing about this problem? Well, those who are making a habit of getting behind on lodgement, you can expect to receive a heightened level of scrutiny from the ATO. So firstly, funds that are behind on lodgement have their complying status on Superfund lookup withheld. And the consequence of this is that it restricts the SMSF from receiving rollovers and employer contributions. And that Superfund lookup status won't be reinstated until lodgement is brought up today. Secondly, trustees will be reminded of their lodgement requirements and the fact that they may not met, may have not met a due date with targeted nudge messages. And whilst our nudge messages do deliver positive results for the majority of trustees, it does take time, and there always remains a persistent group who continue to ignore our reminders. And I guess those that are still left in our population can expect an increase in ATO compliance action, which can lead to significant outcomes, including disqualification. And as part of that process, we're also particularly concerned about the lodgement behaviour that we're seeing for tax agents and auditors that have their own personal SMSF. Now, this is because the number of outstanding SMSF returns for agents and auditors is at a higher level than what we would consider acceptable. And this is because we hold professionals to a higher standard when it comes to meeting their tax and regulatory obligations. And tax agents and auditors should be aware that a disqualification as an SMSF trustee could have implications on their status as a registered professional. And we do refer the outcomes of any disqualifications against tax agents and auditors to the TPB and ASIC for consideration of their registration with their bodies. Sorry, did I say 1,000? Right. No, that is hardly any. Thank you for asking that clarification question, Gemma. Given that we've got the media here, might want to make sure they get that step right too. Okay, I might move along now to market valuations. I was glad to see, Liz, you present your session yesterday to talk through market valuations as part of that, as an area that we have an increase in terms of our focus. And whilst we haven't been targeting market valuations specifically from a compliance point of view, we have noticed a trend where there continues to be a gap between the industry approach to market valuations and ATO expectations. And so more recently, we've been undertaking some deeper analysis of our data to get a better understanding of industry behaviours. And what we've identified is that there are some areas of concern, and this has led to our recent mail out campaign that's captured quite a bit of industry attention. And to provide a little bit of detail in relation to the mail out, it started with some analysis of SAR data, which identified a large number of funds which have reported assets at the same value for at least 3 income years. What we're able to do is then take that data and look at the assets of those funds as reported in the SAR. And what we're able to observe was that the asset classes held by those funds were of a type that you would expect to have been subject to significant market fluctuation over that period of time. Assets such as residential and commercial property were real standout categories for us in relation to our analysis. And this analysis then enabled us to confirm the population of funds where their auditor had not lodged an ACR for a market valuation breach under Regulation 802B. And as part of our correspondence that we sent out in April and May of this year, we accompanied our mail out with supporting messages via our webpage as well as in SMSF news articles. And that mail out went to, or we identified a population, I should say, of just over 16,000 funds and 1,000 auditors who were involved in the audits of those funds. Now, the mail out for the purpose of our action was not a specific compliance action. It was a reminder to trustees and auditors of their obligations when considering the market valuation of their assets when completing their financial statements and annual audit. And our expectation is that the mail out has raised awareness of the ATO's expectations regarding market valuations and fund reporting requirements. But the story won't end there for us. And in terms of what the future holds, we're now invested in seeing how the sector responds to our mail out. So we will be monitoring the behaviour of trustees and auditors as part of understanding their response to the mail out. We do note that there can always be legitimate reasons as to why a fund may have an asset that hasn't changed value in over a 3-year period. However, given the specific asset classes that we're talking about here, property assets in particular, we think it's reasonable to assume, based on what we observe with broader market fluctuations for these types of assets, that we would have seen a change in market valuations over a 3-year period. And in reviewing how the funds and auditors do respond over the next 6 to 12 months via their lodgement of SARs and ACRs, we'll then be in a position to understand whether there is a risk of non-compliance that we may need to dedicate further time and attention to. So moving along to contravention. So next slide brings some focus to what we've been observing around regulatory contraventions and the numbers that we've seen reported by auditors. And from the graph that's there and what the data is telling us is that there is a clear upward trend in contravention reporting. In the last 3 years, the rate has gone from 2.6% of all funds in terms of reporting a contravention, and that's at least one contravention, to almost 3% having reported at least one contravention. Now, I think it's important to recognise that it's still at a healthy level at 3%. That is in itself reflective of a compliance sector. But the increase does suggest that there may be a level of non-compliance that we're starting to see emerge. What is pleasing is that the auditors are also telling us, though, that in 45% of those contraventions that are reported, that they are reported as being rectified by the time the ACR is lodged. So in terms of what is being reported, we do receive contravention reports for a myriad of different CIS breaches. They often overlap, but the main types of contraventions reported we'd say could be classified as 15% in that administrative contravention category, 15% associated with loans or illegal early access, and 11% for in-house asset contraventions and sole purpose. Now to auditors, and more recently we have scaled up our aspects of our compliance program in relation to the auditor space. And I think the headline here for us that we've been talking about publicly is that in 2023-24, we had the highest rate of referral to ASIC for auditor matters, with 45 auditors referred for ASIC consideration. Now, our priority in relation to undertaking a review of auditors is to always focus our compliance work on those that we consider to be the highest risk auditors. However, last financial year, we also introduced a specific focus on undertaking compliance work for auditors who we held intelligence on that suggested that they were continuing to maintain in-house audit arrangements despite the changes to the Code of Ethics for professional accountants in 2020. We also had some targeted compliance work for auditors who were involved in reciprocal audit arrangements, that is those that are auditing each other's personal funds, and we also engaged those who had undertaken any audits in the last five, had not undertaken any audits in the last five years, and for these auditors we incorporated both PII and CPD checks in relation to our review. And as mentioned, based on this work, we did identify behavioural and competence issues which led to our highest rate of referral through to ASIC. Some of that work has been seen in the media this week, with ASIC making an announcement to advise of the suspension of three auditors for having independence concerns following ATO investigation and ASIC referrals. So where are auditors getting it wrong? Well, unfortunately, there are a range of issues where we do observe auditors coming up short of the mark when we do review their audit files. And the first one is auditors who had audit files which demonstrated inadequate evidence or a lack of testing of market valuations under Reg 802B. Now, I've already spent a little bit of time talking about market valuations, so rather than dwelling on market valuations, I'll move on to the next point, which is auditors who did not undertake sufficient testing of the existence, ownership, rights and obligations of the SMSF's assets. Now, this is a Part A audit issue, which relates to auditors conducting testing of the assertions made in the signed financial reports about the existence of assets, entitlements and liabilities. And what we found as a key deficiency was a lack of evidence in relation to asset ownership on the audit file. This included missing source documents, such as title or registry information not being held on the audit file to substantiate fund ownership. We also commonly see auditors who fail to check that trustee declarations have been signed and retained under Section 104A. Trustee declarations are an important document for an SMSF. It does provide affirmation that trustees, as well as directors of corporate trustees, declare that they understand their obligations in running the fund. Now, the trustees must complete the declaration if they become a trustee or the director of a corporate trustee of a new SMSF or existing SMSF, and it must be signed within 21 days of them becoming a trustee or a director of the corporate trustee. Now, many of the audit files that we have been reviewing have not contained the relevant trustee determinations, or the auditor, once identifying that they had the trustee determination, didn't report correctly if it wasn't completed within the 21 days. And the final one to touch on is the next one is arm's length transactions. A lack of confirmation that transactions were conducted at arm's length under Section 109 was again on our hit list last financial year. It always tends to be. There is no catch-all in terms of the 109 transactions that we're talking about, but we do observe it across a broad range of investments and transactions. And the auditor's deficiency in relation to that usually stems from not conducting enough or any verification of supporting documents for transactions, and that could include leases, loan documents, purchase contracts to check for commercial terms and market rate of return. And now the final one I'll talk about is sufficient documentation in relation to LRBAs. And the observation on this one is pretty simple, and that's that the auditors need to be getting the basics right in terms of the evidence that they gather and hold in their audit files. For LRBAs, it's simple things like copies of the bare trust deed, the purchase contract, and ensuring that the loan contract is in the name of the fund with a clause stipulating that the loan is limited in recourse, against the fund trustee or trustees are examples of the things that we observe as missing as part of the order to file, as part of our order to checks. Here, Shelley. So obviously we conducted compliance review of those auditors and they were referred from the HO to ASIC. And so we could see from their client listing that where their clients were sourced from. And that enabled us to determine they were pretty much exclusively working for a single firm referral. So again, it's not an in-house audit issue. That was a single referral source. We're talking pretty much exclusive work coming from one firm. And the findings were essentially in breach of the core principles around independence. So,
the trigger was compliance, wasn't that independence breach, that was a byproduct?
No. So, we'll identify those in relation to core independence issues. That's part of our risk assessment process. So, again, they would fit in that high risk category of auditors. Yep. So, obviously, you can see we're casting that pretty wide in relation to not only high-risk auditor issues, but also the independence issues. So despite the fact we're focusing on in-house audits as part of our program, we're looking at our reciprocal arrangements, and then we're looking at those that have got significant single referral source issues. So to finish up today, I just want to bring some attention to our highest priority focus areas for this year. So obviously independence is one of them, but as mentioned earlier, we expect to release our illegal early access estimate for the 2022 financial year in the coming months. This will continue the narrative we have started earlier this year in bringing focus to this as a problem compliance area. As part of this work, we're going to continue to be closely aligned with ASIC on joint investigations to identify promoters of illegal early access schemes. And we'll continue our efforts to ensure that the system and those running an SMSF are protected from fraud, in particular for the new registration process. But one final area that I did want to talk about today and that we have recently deployed in the final 2 minutes, so I'll make it quick, is our high volume auditor review work. And under this work, we are engaging auditors that regularly undertake in excess of 1,000 audits per year or have had rapid increase in their audit numbers in recent years. And the purpose of these reviews is to build a stronger level of understanding of the auditor's operations so that we can get a level of assurance that the large audit firms have controls, processes and procedures in place that are appropriate and operate effectively. Now, amongst other things, as part of this work, we will look at their independence. We will also look at their audit staff to make sure that they've got the necessary competence to identify and address compliance risks in the SMSFs they audit. And although we're still at the early stages of doing some of this work, we expect it to become a stronger focus and feature of our program, not only in this year, but beyond as well, as we look to have a stronger level of engagement with those larger audit firms. And on that note, I think I've got 1 minute left, Phil. And I'll see if there's any more questions from the floor.
I've got a question online. I guess before I ask the question, I note that the contraventions have increasing, but I wonder if that's because of the program of putting or holding auditors to a higher standard, more contraventions that were being reported rather than there actually being more contraventions?
Yeah, so I think that's going to be part of it. I think one of the parts of undertaking these high-volume auditor review work is that we are getting into some of the details to what some of these firms are reporting. We're looking at their client base and understanding the nature of their investments, and that in itself draws our attention to some of the potential contraventions that we'd normally expect to see reported for those asset holdings. And we know that there's probably some areas, such as 802B, where there's a level of underreporting that's going on, and we're on a pathway at the moment to educate and lift the standard in relation to how 802B is being considered. But we know that there's some other areas as well that's likely to have some underreporting that's going on, and we think in-house assets is probably an area in particular that's going to draw some more attention. And so in terms of the rate, again, I reiterate the point. At 3%, it is pretty low, and it's reflective of a compliance sector. But we also recognise as well that there's probably a level of underreporting that might be going on out there, and we'll work through a process of identifying those issues, bringing attention to it in the public space, and helping educate auditors and trustees as to what their obligations are.
And we've got a question here on the app. Do you have any dedicated method, telephone or email, of alerting the ATO if we find a non-compliance and wish to engage with the ATO early to remedy any perceived breach? And what's your preferred method of contact?
Yeah, so there are ways of engaging with us to provide Dobbin information. So via our webpage, there is a specific forms that referrals can be made. If there is an interest in maintaining anonymity, if I got that right, that would be the preferred pathway. But then there's online services for business as well, where information can be fed to us. And often we have a lot of auditors who do approach us who may have potential concerns. Doesn't necessarily require them to name the fund, the trustees or the other auditor that they may have concerns about, but it enables it, them to provide us some information that we can potentially take a closer look at as well. So there are a variety of forms that are available.
And if it's their own clients, you've got your voluntary disclosure.
Voluntary disclosure process, yes. So again, recognising that there is a large number of contraventions that aren't rectified, and encouraging early engagement on via the voluntary disclosure process is often a good way to work with the ATO to resolve those issues.
All right, I think we've run out of time, so thank you, Paul. Well, join me with thanking Paul for his great presentation.